Okay, Madam Clerk, I think we're ready for the roll.
Trustee Fox.
Here.
Trustee Garrett.
Here.
Trustee Stein.
Here.
Trustee Splendorio is excused, but we do have a quorum.
Great, that's good to hear. Thank you very much. Do we have any public comment?
We do not.
No public comment. So we'll get right to the agenda. The first item on the agenda is item A, approval of the minutes of last month's meeting, which was February 7th, 2024. Are there any additions, corrections, revisions, objections, irritants related to the minutes?
is this where we leave?
All right, hearing none, can we have a motion to approve, please?
Motion to approve. Second.
We have a vote, Madam Clerk.
Trustee Fox.
Aye.
Trustee Garrett.
Aye.
Trustee Stein.
Aye.
The motion passes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Moving right along, we're on to Section B of the agenda. B1 is the report of the Chief Financial Officer. Ms. Miranda.
All right, let me pull up my presentation here. Okay, here we go. So this is the January.
Recording in progress.
This is the January finance report. And starting with our dashboard, I'll make a few comments here. I am thinking that it does cover most of the key metrics in our financial statements. Starting with volume, we've got adjusted discharge and adjusted patient days. We're green. Adjusted discharges are 2% ahead of budget year to date, and we're 4% on adjusted patient days. And that's, again, because our length of stay is longer than we had budgeted. In regard to our revenue cycle, collection ratio looks good. We're at 19.1. Our cash as a percent of revenue here says 100%. We're actually not at 100, and this should be red. Basically, what's going on there is we have only received 1 month of John George payments, and the formula in here eliminated the county payments because they're not posted on a patient account. But that is not what our intent is. Our intent is to show those patient payments in this ratio. So since we've only collected 1 month and it is now February, we'll have 3 months by next month, but we are going to be red until we get caught up with John George. In regard to the days in AR, we're at 63.8 versus 60. 60 was a pretty good target. It's the lowest we have been, but we're doing a lot of work on cleaning up the revenue cycle. So the NPI project is causing us to have more days, and we've had some credentialing issues. And if we don't have our positions credentialed, we can't drop bills. In regard to labor, if you look at our labor standards for our volumes, we're currently at 100% overall. Registry, we wanted to be at 4.1. We have a grid item to reduce registry, and we have not succeeded in doing that. It's probably particularly high now because of the holidays. And of course, seasonality, January.
Question, the graph that's headed lower, is that productivity or is that registry?
That is, I'm not sure because it doesn't look like it would be either one to me. So let me, I'll have to take that back and check on that.
It seems like, you know, registry over time is going down.
Yeah, it's gone down a bit. Mostly the rates have gone down. So I'll probably need to look at what they're measuring there, because if they're measuring dollars, that would make sense, because we have seen a huge in our registry rates. So let me go back and check on that.
While we're pausing here, I'm puzzled by the productivity.
Yes.
Is this like, is it 100% because we budgeted conservatively for that, or I don't understand what productive hours per unit of service is doing.
So our volumes are up, so that means we're going to use more FTE. But for the labor standards, if we approve a position in our work committee, we adjust that labor standard, because regardless of what the budget said. So we're, those labor standards do move based on approvals in work committee. But most of it is driven because our adjusted patient days are up. So that gives the departments with the variable work standard more FTE.
Well, whose labor are we talking about?
So there's a, and maybe we should come back and do a whole presentation on this, but yeah, all of our variable departments, based on whatever their unit of service is, calculates how many FTE they have.
Oh. Okay.
And we can come back and, you know, do an education on that.
Ms. Miranda, through the chair, I'd like to request that, because this is confusing. On the face of it, it just, productivity means different things in different audiences and different venues, and my understanding doesn't sync with. Yes, so that would be great to come back with more clarification on this.
Okay.
Just as an overall, 100%, if you're at 100%, it means that you're not using any more manpower or labor power than you should be using given the level of volumes. If you're at 102%, then you're using less than the standard says you need. And if you're at 98%, you're using more.
I see.
There's a lot more to explain, but that's.
Yeah, so overall, you know, the target is 100. That would be, you know, if we were absolutely perfect everywhere. We don't actually put where we're running here, but we are green, so we're better than 100. So we're probably 100.5 or something.
Mm. Oh, the target's 100.
Yeah, this whole, the way we did this was to eliminate numbers, was just put the target, and then are we achieving it or not? So we can, you know, always go back and readdress that. And I didn't pull the report to put exactly what it is, but it's probably just a little bit over 100.
Mm-hmm. So just, I'm sorry, one more point on this is productivity sometimes is defined by provider productivity, but that's not what this is what I'm understanding now.
No, in fact, physician productivity is not even in this.
In
number.
This at all. Very
yeah.
Good. Okay, understood. Very good. Thank you.
Okay, so we are over in FTEs, and again, some of that because our adjusted patient days are above budget. Our labor costs for FTE, mostly because of overtime, is red. Our profitability, if you look at it per adjusted discharge, per adjusted days, we are red, and that's because our expenses are over in every category by $20.7 million or 2.1%. Our net income should actually be green at this point because we are favorable. So I'll have to go back and look at the formula behind this particular item. We do have a loss year to date, but it is better than the loss we had budgeted. So I'm sure it has something to do with the double negatives. And then on our EBITDA, we're green. We're actually $5.2 million better than budget. Our net negative balance here is green. It actually should be red. We're at 128.4, which is more than the 105. So we're, you know, at the top end of what we're allowed to draw on our line of credit with the county. And our net position is red because we still have a net deficit of 86.3 million. Again, the net deficit is if we closed operations tomorrow, we wouldn't have assets to pay our debts. On the capital, we are still behind in our spend, but much better than we have been in many years, much closer. And our GRIT, we reported our second quarter to you all. We were behind. We generated $3.5 million in these initiatives, but we're 9.3 behind where we had wanted to be at this point second quarter. So there's the overall dashboard. Any other questions on that?
I have one more historical question. So we put the target up there, but we don't actually put the numerical outcome or performance. We just see a green or red dot and a trend. Is it ever been considered to actually put the actual number there?
This is brand new. We just did this because we wanted, you know, we wanted like one place where folks could look and see how our organization is doing. So this is brand new with this finance committee. So we can change it. We had wanted it to be easy for somebody to read that wasn't like a finance person per se. We can always do that. This was our first try at it. We wanted to put as little on the page as possible. So I don't know if our
for discussion. Some other time, maybe offline, or I don't know, we can talk offline, but maybe for some other time, is it would be next to target, you would have actual. So the only thing you would be adding is a column between target and year to date, and it would be the actual. And then you would put your actual result there so that it would give a sense of scale, because you're verbally telling us, but we can't, from looking at this, understand what the actual number is. So the order of magnitude isn't clear to me.
All right. We'll be happy to add that.
This was intended to be kind of like a glance at this, but this is like the third month we've had it or something like that. So
okay, just a suggestion.
We can definitely look toward improving it in the direction that the board would like to see.
So, okay. Well,
thank you for that
comment. Add that. We'll add that.
Thank you for entertaining comment.
We'll add it for next time.
Thank you.
Okay, so here is the volume chart. Lots of numbers here. Basically, January volumes were down, mostly in the inpatient area. We were above budget in the outpatient. Emergency room was very, very busy. Our surgeries were down. Over in the skilled nursing area, we were doing quite well. We hit our discharge target, and we also had either bed, we're basically paid for all the patients in the bed, so we were doing quite well. On the clinic visits, we were also ahead of budget, 4%. Our adjusted statistics are good, thanks to the outpatient drivers. And our payer mix, we left it in here. We don't always put it in here, mostly just because we were surprised by the drop in the commercial insurance in the 1 month. So year to date, we're ahead 6.8%, and we're down 13.4% in the month of January, and that directly correlates to the fewer trauma cases. We're down 5%. So,
the question: the trend of outpatient surgeries had been pretty favorable, and this is the first month I remember that they were really well below budget, 8% below budget. Anything in particular? Or some of the surgeons on vacation in January, or
there were three holidays. I'm sure that contributed. I don't know how much, and they all happened to be on like Mondays.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a big block day.
Yeah.
So here's our results for the month. Our net income was a loss of $7.4 million. Which was actually pretty close to budget. We had budgeted a loss of $7.1 million. And one thing to remember when you look at what typically would be a busy month, I mean, normally January, February, March are busy months with seasonality, about half of our money comes in from, you know, the services for patients. The other half is supplementals that do, you know, that are, we accrue evenly. So oftentimes in busier months, we will have bigger losses. So that's why the budget is the way it is. And then, of course, in January, we actually did not see the seasonality of previous years, particularly the inpatient side.
But it almost looked like you anticipated it, because the budget for the month was a large loss also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I think we understood the supplemental side of it, right? But I think we did budget for higher volumes. Year to date, we are actually ahead of budget, 3.5 million, which is why it should have been green on the dashboard. And on an EBITDA basis, we are 5.2 better than budget year to date. So in regard to revenue, this is net patient service revenue slide, you can see that even though our inpatient volumes were down quite a bit, actually, 3.8%, and our length of stay was equal to where we are year to date, but a full half of a day less than we were last year. So that is a significant improvement, half a day for every single patient. And our CMI was high, which, you know, normally you don't see that. But we looked into it, and it is basically being driven by some neuro cases and some echo trach cases. So it was a unique month that way. So ED was really strong, and so was CT and endo. That's why the outpatient was so high. And inpatient is, of course, because the physicians charge for every ED visit, and also the clinic visits were high. So we beat our gross charge budget by 4.1%, and then we also beat our net patient revenue. So we have a favorable variance of 3.5, so that's some volume, but the biggest part of it is we saw our 340B pharmacy settlement of 2.4 million. So the American Hospital Association and CMS went all the way to the Supreme Court, and CMS was ordered to make all of the hospitals whole to basically ASP, which is average sales price, plus 6% handling fee for drugs. They were using modifiers to discount what they paid us, and they were told they cannot do that. Still have to report to them that they can't pay us differently. So we were glad to see this. We had expected 2.9. We got another half a million in 2022 because we were on top of this, and we started rebuilding these claims. And so we're validating it, but we think we got everything we're supposed to get.
Does that ruling impact government payments as well as private commercial patients?
This is just Medicare.
Just Medicare.
All right, so that really helped our net patient revenue, despite the fact that we had such, you know, a decrease in our commercial payer mix. So on the supplemental side of things, we got a little bit more money on the calendar year 22 Medi-Cal waiver. I'm sorry, the calendar year 23 GPP, which is the waiver. So that was a nice pickup, and that is likely to continue. It's a small number, but it's always nice when we start to see a little more money coming in. Unfortunately, year to date, the 4.1 million was due to the COVID threshold reduction, which allowed us to get full funding, which is not gonna happen again. So, and unfortunately too, for the supplemental programs where we're 3.7 million better, that's mostly because we got 3 years of GME all in 1 year. GME did go up. We're going to get a little more money, but we're not going to get multiple years. So none of that is recurring money.
That's a catch-up?
Yes. Yeah. Got final payments on them. And other revenue there is going strong, and that's retail pharmacy. Year-to-date, we've also got that Anthem settlement in there, 1.1. On the expense side of things, as I mentioned, we are over budget in every category for the year and pretty much every category for the month. We're 3.9% higher than budget, and the biggest driver is the labor costs, which we'll talk about in a minute. In regard to the expenses, we'll talk about the physicians altogether, the total physician expense. Purchase services is really being driven by higher transitional housing costs. We are investing a lot of money in trying to get that length of stay down, and so we are, you know, paying to have our patients in transitional housing. For materials and supplies, it's really more timing than anything else, other than pharmacy. Pharmacy is can see year-to-date is the single biggest driver. And for the retail pharmacy, of course, we have a margin. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think we separated it out. The retail is 2.5, so we have a margin on that. And then 1.6 year-to-date is just higher rates. And the CPI for pharmacy has been really high.
So comment on expenses. One thing I noticed is that if you take a look at what our average revenue and expenses were, average per month for the first 6 months of the year, our net revenue was just about where it had been every month in January, just about the same as the average for the first 6 months. But our expenses were about $10 million higher than they have been on the average. So we really took a jump up, and it seems like most of it is labor. So I guess the question I have is that going to continue? Are there some labor, some rate increases that kicked in at the beginning of the year?
So there's a couple of things. We had a lot more FTE in January, and I think some of it is, you know, we were getting ready for the busy season, and we brought on a lot of registry. And then our volumes didn't, at least on the inpatient side, didn't materialize. And then if you look, I have a slide here, you probably just go here right now. If you look at this slide, you can see that the gold or yellow, which is the productive, this is our productive staff. A lot of them were gone in January, whether it was New Year's or, you know, holidays. And so you saw, we saw a lot more overtime and a lot more registry. So the non-productive times, we're still paying them, but they were off. We ended up with more registry, and if you look at this, we're 218 paid FTE higher than our plan.
And those registry folks, are they mostly local registry that we can, we don't have to keep them here in February and March, or are they a lot, are we have a lot of travelers?
Travelers.
So we're committed to some of those folks?
We're committed, the weeks vary. And up to 13, but they can be as, I think, low as 6 now or something like that. So it's being monitored.
So here's the little spreadsheet on our staff. You can see that our rate variance pretty much offset in January. We budgeted for the COVID shift differential, which went away. We're not paying people to take extra shifts in the way we were during the pandemic. And also we budgeted for severance. So we didn't have severance. So there's two offsetting favorable variances. Overtime continues to run more than planned. And then the big variance is in volume. We had 130 paid FTE more than plan. In regard to registry, I just want to point out that yes, we had 85 more FTE, and remember we reduced registry as part of our grit or our bridge plan, however you want to say it, and we haven't gotten that reduction in registry, but we are seeing much lower rates. So nice positive offset to the volume in the rate. So this next slide is the view of total physician expense. And we do have a presentation based on your request from, I think it was 2 months ago. So right now we're pretty much right on budget. We approximate budget, but we'll talk about that in the following presentation. Next slide is the benefits. We saw a big jump in our health claims. So we are self-insured, so we make payments on those claims. We also saw increases like for our employee, for Kaiser, and for some of the other employee benefits. So that's the key driver in regard to why benefits are unfavorable for the month. And remember, in December, we did a big true-up because there was a spread problem in EPSI. So, you know, we were thinking we would eliminate these variances, but unfortunately, because of all those claims, That's not the case in regard to the benefits. Retirement is pretty much right on budget, but I do want to point out that we had a favorable ACERA variance that was offset by AHMG. AHMG allows their employees to max out their retirement at the beginning of the year rather than space it out. So they can all put their money in right away, and then that way, if they, you know, if they were to terminate, they would lose, you know, they would be able to. So it's just something that's unique to AHMG. So here's the balance sheet, and our days in AR did go up. We're at 63.8 and 44.6 for net. The key reasons for that are actually on this next slide here. We are doing a huge NPI cleanup. I don't know why, but over many, many, many years, we had so many NPIs. We had them for every payer, for every site, you know, all over the place. So we are doing a huge correction in that, and it has caused some delays and some issues with our AR balance and also with credentialing. We've had all kinds of, we've had a lot of physicians start, and we have to be credentialed, so we have to hold claims. So the credentialing is another factor impacting our days. We did have a good collection month for HB, so that helped. That was actually positive, so the increase in our days wasn't too significant. And then over on PB, we didn't have such a good collection month, mostly due to the holidays. I put big red there. I'm sure you've all heard about the Change Healthcare and cyber attack. Well, I put in quite a few slides in here of the newspaper. I don't know how much you all know about that. I have Sherry on the line here, and
Kevin's in the back.
Oh, and
there.
Kevin's here too. So I don't know. Maybe you guys could. This is a big deal, because if we can't get our claims to the payers, we aren't going to get paid, and we're already at the top of our NND. So this is a huge issue for Alamo Health System. So maybe we could start with an explanation of kind of what happened.
Yeah, so I can talk through what happened to Change, and I will be transparent. I pinged the jaws. You all met our CISO to get a little bit of the up-to-date on this. So I've got some cliff notes here on this with what occurred in there. Because I honestly, it's been breaking. I was on a couple of conversations actually with CIOs when I was at a conference last week, because this was a big topic of discussion there, and learned something.
Is that his list?
It's a CHIME conference, College of Health Information Management Executives, which I'm a member of, and it's which was down in Los Angeles last week. And so we had several conference calls about this because it was breaking at the time. So the actual hack occurred back on February 21. It's a Russian-sponsored cyber terrorist group that sponsored this or did this called Black Hat. And they operate out of Russia. Connected, the speculation is with the Russian government, but details on that are always a little bit sketchy on that, so I won't speculate too far in that. It's the same group that did the Colonial Pipeline, and as well as the Caesar and MGM entertainment hacks as well. So they're well known on this. They basically operate as a ransomware for hire group as well, and so you can contract with them to ransomware your enemies, and they'll do that. And they made off with somewhere around 6 terabytes of data from Change Healthcare. So a significant amount of data, a huge amount of data that was taken. Around March 1st, and I'm going to use the word allegedly, because John's told me to make sure to use that word. Around March 1st, Change Healthcare allegedly actually paid the ransom of somewhere around $22 million and then did not get their data back. And so that was obviously unfortunate in that both accounts. And so Change Healthcare is now working to do recovery of their systems. Unfortunately, and I was actually at another organization where we had a sister organization, not mine, that went through this. And when you are rebuilding your systems from scratch, you literally have to bring up system by system, because what occurs is if you bring up your systems together, you run the risk of bringing the bad actor back into the system with you. And in my past experience with this, the organization that I was watching closely and doing this actually brought up their systems three times, and each time found they were working with the FBI, the time found that they had the bad actor in the system. At the time, they finally wiped all of their systems and basically started over with no data, and forced each one of their employees to come in person to present themselves with government ID that be attested into the system. So it's a huge problem that Change Healthcare has at this point. Another anecdotal thing that I heard when I was at Vive last week was that the Change Healthcare people were literally all of their laptops, et cetera, they're taken away from them. They were all, the only thing they had to work on was their phones, which were considered to still be somewhat secure in nature on them. So, that's basically what is going on from a Change Healthcare standpoint. There's a lot of speculation on how long they could be down, and speculation right now ranges from the length of 6 weeks to 2 months.
And they're a subsidiary of Optum, is that right?
Correct. And, loosely impacts somewhere around half of the U.S.'s healthcare billing services in nature. So very, very significant blow to the U.S.
Yeah, they manage 15 billion transactions a year.
So huge amount of impact on that.
And has that impacted our days too at the end of February?
Yes. So I have there's a mitigation plan here. I don't know, Sherry, if you want to speak to that and what you're doing and how long we think things are going to go.
Yeah, thanks, Kim. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. So right now our days in AR are around 71. We bill about $10 million a day. We've been holding claims for about around 14 days. We are billing claims manually, sending out to our biggest payer, Alameda Alliance. We've been printing and actually mailing. We're also hand keying as much as we can directly into the Medicare system to keep claims going out, in some sort of fashion. One of our biggest strategy is to transition from a single source vendor to a multi-source vendor for our claim submission, so that we're not in this vulnerability again. So within the next 5 to 7 days, we anticipate being connected with a new vendor called Availity. And then the next strategy is to create a relationship with Experian and bring them into our area within the next, it's going to be roughly 10 to 15 days to bring them in to get our claims out the door. It's going to be very important also to get our remittances, which is how we get our money back from the payers. So both of those vendors are working with us to ensure that we can get our claims out and bring them in. So they've got lifeline packets that they're, giving out to a lot of the hospitals. I mean, this is happening for everybody. And so everybody's really coming together and trying to create this pathway to get our claims and payments in.
So all of these companies like Experian must be just oversubscribed with, all the hospitals in the country, practically, are trying to do the same thing we're trying to do, right?
Oh, yeah. Sherry, she's been, her team and Kevin, these guys have been, this has been all hands on deck since this happened. We've been crazy.
Yeah, the vendors have pivoted quickly because they understand the impact to the entire industry. And are willing to, they avoid sales pitch and go right to, how can we get you set up? And Availity, when we first started talking with them, they were like, how can we help? We can get you stood up within 2 to 3 days after the contract signed. So both Sherry's team and my team from an IS perspective are at the ready. Once we get approval and get the contract signed, we can move into doing the configuration and setup, because a lot of that could be repurposed, because we use standard formats with files that we send to the clearinghouses and to the payers.
So we just have to oversimplify it is kind of repoint to this new vendor to start sending those files.
And we've got the agreement signed, I believe, Ahmad.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so is our plan not to go back to change healthcare after this is all over? Or not to go back to the extent we depended on them before?
I think, why don't you answer that, Chair?
Yeah, this is a good time to divorce Change Healthcare. We won't go back.
So that's going to be a big hit to Optum, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, I can't even imagine what they're thinking right now. I mean, it'll be amazing if they can survive.
Yeah.
Optum as a company, you mean?
Well, I don't know.
It's like a child of a child of the parent. So the parent is United Health. With Optum, and then Optum acquired Change.
Okay. And do we think it was a very clever breach on behalf of the bad guys here, or were Change's firewalls, you know, not as impermeable as maybe they thought?
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation on that, and you know, I've done some reading on my own. I talked with the Jaws or CISO on that. I'll go into pure speculation here for a little bit. There's a couple of tools that have been singled out that they believe might have been compromised with what's called a zero-day breach, meaning a breach that was found and then outputted. Interestingly, in reading through this, there is some speculation that as much as 40% of American companies may have bad actors in the company at this point. From either Russia, China, Iran, other areas like that, and could have a switch kind of flip like happen to Change at a given notice. There's also speculation about the time when this occurred versus some additional sanctions that went in from the U.S. to Russia. And again, this is all speculation, so I'm not trying to be too conspiracy on it, but it is interesting on the timing on these things.
Mark, I don't think that's too much conspiracy. Our recent ransomware attack, which shut us down for 2 months, was exactly that, a Russian actor. It was Lockbit and the FBI and all involved, and we went through this exact thing, and it turns out that through a phishing attempt, they were able to get into our systems. They were in our systems for over a month before they flipped the switch. They were observing everything we were doing, had full, complete access, and then they decided to flip the switch. And I don't want to talk about the resolution to that, but we're back up and running now, but, well, they were in our system for over a month.
Yeah, that's very typical, and a month is actually considered a fairly short time to be in before they do that.
Well, this type of occurrence is yet another reason why we need a line of credit with the county. Because if we have cash flow interruption, you know, we have no cushion on our own.
Right.
We have to depend on the county without them getting totally blown out of shape when we have to draw.
And this may escalate the need to have a conversation sooner than waiting until June. I don't know, Sherry, and also too, I want, Emily's also on the line today. Emily, she is our director over hospital billing. She's under Sherry. She's been here, what, about a year now, Sherry?
Yes.
So I don't know if you want to introduce her, but what I was going to ask one of you is how long do you think maybe we'll get caught up in our cash flow? I mean, we're up to 71 days now. We've got the new vendor on board. Any ideas at this point?
You know, speculating, I would say it's anywhere between 30 to 45 days. I mean, Medicare can pay us within 14 days of receipt, which is good. Alameda Alliance, Emily, you've been sending claims out to them. They've been responsive. So that's a strong partnership for us. So hopefully it's, you know, 30 days, but I anticipate 30 to 45 and maybe a little bit longer for some of those commercial plans that delay, you know, on top of that, just not to pay. And by the way, Emily White is, yes, thanks for introducing her, Kim. And I'm very pleased that she's here, and she's a great leader for patient financial services. So welcome, Emily. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And so this is the claim volume in dollars on hold through February 27th. So it's significant.
Kim, if I can just, one other thing, on both your team, Sherry and Emily, as as well as Kevin and Diane from our pharmacy. You know, these people all have day jobs, and for them to pivot like they have, I mean, this has taken hours and hours and hours of all their time. It's been a huge effort on all of them. It's been just a huge and you know, really public recognition to them for the work they've done around this. And Kim, for you as well on this, it's been dramatic on the impact it's had on our organization.
Yeah, I just want to touch on the prescription, because prescription eligibility verification was impacted because we used Change for that, but we did work with a vendor called RxLink, and they, within 3 days, had us up and running. It took us a little bit to get through getting the contract from them and getting through the paperwork, but within 3 days, we were up and running, and right now, no impact other than some inconveniences to our patient population, but everything is running as it did prior to different vendor, but we've mitigated that risk.
And this is claim value with gross charges, right?
Yeah.
So just for the benefit of the committee, that $99 million, bottom line, bottom right, that's billed, charges billed, the actual net we expect to get from these, well, held up claims is about $19 million, because our net to gross is 19%.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about claims until they're adjudicated by the payer, you're usually talking about the gross charges amount.
And of course, this is growing. But I, you know, Diane in the pharmacy, I mean, she was on this. I was just thrilled at the response from my team, from pharmacy, from Mark's team, everybody. I mean, and then legal, getting all these agreements done. I mean, talk about, you know, a well-oiled machine moving. I mean, it was really something to watch.
Well, as a board, it's good to see the team react quickly and spend the time that's needed, so thank you.
And nobody first saw this, obviously. Just them, sorry.
Yeah, well, in compliance, Bonnie Leong, our privacy officer, Marilyn Boston's team, she was a huge help. So yeah, just a big team effort.
Yeah, because nothing happens without getting the legal contract signed through. So sorry about that, Amon.
One more question for Kim, and again, echoing what the chair said, thank you to the teams, Herculean effort. We went through this, and so I have some sense of what you're going through. So as the chair said, thank you to the teams and everyone. Remind me again, NNB, in your earlier part of your report, you said we're at or exceeding NNB. Or remind me, please. And in your assessment of the impact of this on NNB and the need for accelerating the conversation with the county, can we just have a brief conversation on that, please?
Yeah, I've got some more slides too on that topic. We're at 128 right now, and
right. We
have to be at 105 on June 3rd.
Exactly.
So we can go up to 150, which we're almost there, right? The good news is this is springtime when most of our supplementals come in, so that is going to help us. And if we can get this, you know, squared away and you know, payers like Alliance stepping up and, you know, getting us paid is huge.
Yeah.
But I think we need to let the county know that there is the possibility that we will exceed the 150, and we're going to need some additional funding probably in the next 45 days.
So if I may, Kim had obviously shared this previously and with me, and I had, and also she had a conversation with Melissa Woke, who was the controller. That's
under control.
Yeah, for the county. And Melissa, I think rightly, was reluctant to commit to anything. So I had a subsequent conversation with the Chief Administrative Officer, Susan Marnici, for the county, and she was open. She didn't commit, but certainly opened the door to the fact that we want to have a conversation sooner as opposed to later about the NNB and the fact that it hasn't moved since 2017.
It goes down every year. So
yeah, but the adjustment factor, I guess, because the opener happened a few years ago and we did not avail ourselves of it. So Susan is aware and knows that we want to pursue that with the county.
And this whole thing with Change Healthcare just happened, right? So we were already having this conversation when this whole cyber attack happened to Change. So we are. Because of all the effort that's happening in accounts receivable, manually putting claims in and getting funding, you know, and because the claims that were already out to be paid, that money's coming in. The real hit to cash is going to happen now. So we are working on trying to estimate that.
And this is after the NNB basically doubled in January. Like, we were at 64 million in December, and now we're at 128 million.
Yeah, and we projected that because we don't have the supplemental funding coming in. So we are actually been projecting pretty close to where we've been running. This Change Healthcare is a new glitch that just happened. And again, we haven't seen the impact of it yet because we've had claims filled out that are, getting paid.
That was what I was thinking. Point of clarification, James, did your conversations happen before or after awareness of this ransomware?
Prior to.
Mm-hmm. So they're not even, this adds to that conversation.
It does.
Very good.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's what's going to need us to escalate it sooner.
The March is going to be a rough month.
Yes. All right, so here's the patient collections here. At 62.2 and Epic, it's not a bad month. As I told you, HB did better than trend, and PB was under trend. We did receive money for behavioral health, so this was another key factor in our NNB going up. This is the first payment we've gotten for claims for John George Hospital for this fiscal year. So first payment coming in January for services in July, okay? So that is another reason why that NNB has been going up. We also got two more payments in February. You'll see that on a subsequent slide. And I still don't know how much money we're going to get, right? Because the interim contract was $43 million with the county. And we really should have been getting about $75 million, right, if history repeated itself. So there's a big funding gap there. We know that there's been a SPA that's been accepted with CMS to change the rates that were set under CalInc because they used very old data. For us, it was particularly old. So
long as the volume you need?
It's the rate we get, like for an inpatient day, it's too low. And of course, CPI was what, 7%? So they gave a factor of like 3%. So there's a lot of stuff going on with the CalNP schedule. And then it's different. We can now bill for a lot of professional fees, which we've never been able to bill for before. And nobody understands the billing yet. And the county's billing system is not up yet. So it was supposed to be up in, July, August. And here we are in March, and it's still not up. So the county can't even bill the state to get any funding to pay us.
When the county system is up, will this gap that we have every year for the first 6-7 months, will that be eliminated?
So right now we have an interim contract for only 43. So the hope is that this fall will allow the state to recalculate our rates and we'll be restored back to the mid-70 range. And then we will have to somehow get all this claims data into the new billing system to bill. And of course you have 1 year to get all of your claims in. So July is just around the corner.
Any of this retroactive if rates were modified?
Well, they said they would make them retro to be October, the second quarter of the fiscal year. But we've been pushing hard, we need them to go back to the beginning of the fiscal year, July 1. Because that 3 month period is like $6 million. So anyway, that's the update on that. And here's the NNB. And this hasn't really changed much from last month, except for now we are $4 million over in June 30, 25. Our budget has not been done yet. We will update this when we get our budget, but this is putting a lot of pressure on our budget. And as we reported, and the county knows, because of the timing of supplementals, we were going to need some help because we're way over that line there. But as of today, because I haven't put the Change Healthcare impact in here, we're still below for this year. But that could change if we can't, if Sherry and her team, they are doing everything manually to get these claims in so we can get paid. But we're going to be doing some extrapolations now that we kind of have an idea of who can pay us and who isn't, and you know how long it's going to take to get our new vendor up and running. Okay, so here's the table, and really the thing to point out is the timing of our supplementals. Now that all these programs have become calendar year, our money comes in the spring, so we're always going to have, you know, January, December, February timeframe where we're waiting to get that funding. So, and CAPH is well aware of this because all the public hospitals have the same issue and they're trying to get interim payments on some of the programs. So they're working. So that is the finance report. This is just the assumptions which are not have not changed since last time.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Comments? So about the Change Healthcare, if you're saying, like you said, Mark, that may have been a retribution for the some of the sanctions, which were directly a result of the death of Mr. Navalny. So we're seeing what seemed to be an international event that happened halfway across the world is impacting us right here in Alameda County.
Purely speculative.
If that's the case. Of course, knowing who runs things over in Russia, it wouldn't be a surprise at all. Don't put that in the minutes.
When Alan's
too late, they already heard you. It's too late.
I mean, somebody around this table.
Yeah. No, I mean they're listening. They're listening.
They're watching.
They're
drinking.
I have my tin hat on.
Luckily, there's no borscht here.
Right. Well, let me mention one thing on this, and I won't go into details for obvious reasons. But I specifically, you know, with Jaws, and I had some discussion about what our speculation is on what occurred and what we're doing at AHS to try to prevent that. And certainly no solution is foolproof. I'd be a fool to say that, but we are doing our best to try to mitigate those sorts of situations in our own cybersecurity posture with what we're doing. So you always take these situations as best you can as a learning situation to try to further harden your own situation. And we've got a couple of projects that are in place that were already in place. We're now accelerating to try to get certain additional security controls that are hardened.
You know better than me that you're the subject matter expert, just from our experience, phishing attempts and training of staff not to click on that email, even if it looks like it's coming from your boss or someone in the agency, which happened to us. Don't, if it looks suspicious, don't click on it. So phishing, we're now going through agency-wide training on and retraining on phishing, so I just FYI.
Yeah, if I can, just one very quick anecdotal. We, when I worked for the UC system, we started our first phishing campaign there, and one of my CIO counterparts at another healthcare system was quite concerned that he would have a lot of phishing hits. So their very first phishing email that they sent out said in big red letters at the top, highlighted in yellow, "This is a phishing email. Do not click on it." 60% click rate.
Exactly.
So wrong.
And then when you add to that, then
exactly.
Are we getting something like 100,000 phishing attempts a day or something like that?
We actually block, we only let in, so we all get a lot of phishing emails. James, I know, gets them periodically. Kim gets them periodically. I do, et cetera. Felicia, et cetera, because we go out and we proactively been trying to pull them back out of mailboxes and so on. We let in less than 10% of the mail that we get hit with every day. So if you think about it, all the mail that you get every day in your mailbox, we block 90% of the mail coming in.
Which isn't all phishing. Some of it is just
marketing,
yeah,
and
that, okay,
other
but
junk spam.
Some percentage,
yeah,
of that,
yeah,
is likely,
yeah,
phishing, yes. Yes.
So, but we block 90% of the mail coming into AHS every day.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you for having your arms around this thing and protecting us.
Good CISO and good CTO were the key for that.
All right. We're going on to the next item on the agenda, which is item C1. Which is a report on Alameda Health Medical Group, otherwise known as AHMG. The Alameda Health Medical Group is a probably the majority of our physicians, I think, in AHS, represents the majority of our physician-related expenses in AHS. And for the last few years, the expenses have been above what the PSA agreement, the professional services agreement, called for, which had been agreed upon by the administration and the board and Alameda Health Medical Group. So this is going to be a recap of what's going on and where we're headed with AHMG. Ms. Miranda and Dr. Tornabene are presenting.
Yes, and so this is the budget update, and it stems from this slide in the finance deck, and Trustee Fox, you asked Dr. Tornabene and I to go back and take a look at some of these large variances here and let you know whether we felt like we would be able to hit budget this year for physician expense, which has, again, the AHS piece of it and the AHMG piece. So this gives you the full picture through December. And what we can say is, I'll start just from the highest level, we're basically right on budget. We're approximating budget here. So will we stay on budget? I do not think so. I think we will end the fiscal year over budget. We know that we had built in $1.2 million to settle the SEIU contract. That's only 6 months worth, so 2.4 total. So far, AHMG is 900 below, but that would put them 300 over right now in December, and then another potentially 300 for the next 6 months. And then, of course, we haven't figured out what the actual contract settled at. That's, you know, there's a lot of work that has to get done in that, and that's happening now. So we don't know how close this number will be to the final settled number. And then in addition to that, we had a lot of vacancies in the beginning of the year. We had some terminations. And so the AHMG started out favorable. And of course, now with recruiting, the next 6 months will be more expensive than the first 6 months. So that's from the highest level. And then, you know, you can see in some cases AHMG might be over, and then we're under on AHS side. So it's kind of all over the board. So I don't know if you want to
Sure. Yeah, I can talk through some of the specific specialties that are here on the slide. Starting from the top, just you can see, Trustee Fox, you had a question about anesthesiology, and so I'll just start there. That if you look at the clinical shifts for the Department of Anesthesiology, and anesthesiology covers our ORs, there's always anesthesiology available on labor and delivery. They staff our endoscopy suites. And that comes to a total of about 24.8 FTEs of work just by adding up the clinical shifts across the organization. So the department has been working for years on trying to ultimately move away from using locum tenens and a lot of overtime. They have been, you know, using both, and you can see both reflected here in the variances, both in the contract and then the salaries. And last year, they hired in a 2.6 FTE from new FTE from anesthesia to cover, and they're still in the process of hiring additional anesthesiologists, which ultimately will reduce the contract costs and have the locum tenens really driving that down. I know Dr. Phyllis Warren is on the line too, so she's here supporting the conversation. So that's anesthesiology. I think as you see here from the notes here for orthopedics, that we did hire our permanent chair, Dr. DeStefano, and there have been some new hires as well into that department, but you see that the contracts are declining. So we're transitioning some of those contract labor into hires. Radiology, this is an important story over the last year, because we, in the we knew that we had to provide 24/7 interventional radiology call. That has been multiple years of work to really get to the place in November of 23 when we finally launched 24-hour interventional radiology call. And we effectively had to separate out our diagnostic radiology and interventional radiology pools. So in order to stand up an IR call pool. So on the IR side, we are trying to hire for ultimately a total of 4 internal FTEs to cover that service. In current state right now, we have 2 internal IR employees. And then we have to bring in locum tenens coverage just to have call coverage. And then we're also working with UCSF. They're also going to be helping cover by contract some of the gaps. So this will be an ongoing story in radiology, but some of our employed IR docs, because they were taking all the IR call, they backed out of the DR call, the diagnostic radiology call. So we're having to backfill for that as well. Also with locum tenens, and we had some departures in radiology. Multiple departures in OB-GYN as well. And then we have been bringing in locum tenens staff in order to cover some of those clinical shifts. And there has been, you know, labor and delivery has certainly been busier, and the acuity is higher. And then we also had some of our residents depart, and so we actually have had to have additional coverage with some of our own internal staff to help back up labor and delivery coverage and acute gyne rounding as well. There was a new hire in neurology, a lot of outpatient coverage. In rehab, one of our PM&R docs was out on a medical leave, and so we had locum tenens coverage for that. For hospitalists, particularly at Highland, we added a team 8 for the winter in order to help cover kind of the winter medicine surge, and that's sunsetting, I think, either has been or it's imminent. To go back to our usual team seven teams for the Highland Hospital.
So
those are some key updates.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Doctor.
No. How many are in the team, please?
How many patients per team? So
when you said move to 8 teams versus 7, a team is comprised of.
Oh, I see your question. Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
So right now at Highland on the hospital service, we have 6 teaching teams and 1 attending only team. For the winter surge, we added a 8th team that it was a second attending only team. So the 6 teaching teams have, you know, residents and interns on those teams, and then attending only teams are the, you know, the attending just cares for their panel.
So nevertheless, I mean, we do have some very large favorable variances too.
Mm-hmm.
Such as OBGYN.
Yes. Yeah. That's a movement and departures care. So with that, I just wanted to share a high level again overview of what globally has been happening over the last few years. Certainly a large effort to employ a physician workforce over the last 4 years in prior times that, you know, we had Alameda Health System, we had an internal medical group, which was Alameda Health Partners. We also had a large contract with Oak Care Medical Group. And as we know, a number of years ago, then there was the formation of what was called EDMG at the time in order to create a large employed physician workforce. There has been significant growth, as you know, over the last 2 years with growth in a number of services, but also some stabilization. And some of that growth has been, there are some specialties that were contract medical services, but then we decided to bring them into HNG. ENT is an example of that, plastic surgery. And so there were some specialties that were contractors that we brought into the group as employees, but we certainly have had and will continue to have key partnerships with some external medical groups, you know, UCSF. They cover general surgery, trauma, neurosurgery, maternal fetal medicine, and oral maxillofacial surgery. Great partners of ours, Alameda Inpatient Medical. They are a group that we work with. They're hospitalists and internal medicine docs, and they help round up post-acute, Alameda Hospital, John George, and then Traditions Behavioral Health. You know, we've had a long-standing contract with them for some psychiatry coverage. And of course, there is use of local tenant staffing, but ultimately, and our physician leaders all know that the use of that is for these special circumstances. We want to, it's never be a long-term strategy. Ultimately, we'd like to minimize the use of long-term of locum tenens, but it happens when there's medical needs, et cetera. So with that, I'll turn it back to Kim.
I had a question on the recruitment.
Sure.
If I read this right, I had a note that in 2023, there were 14 hires budgeted. And there were 33 actually hired. And, you know, we've also been looking at double digit increases in our physician, our overall costs for the PSA. And it seems to me like we need better controls between AHS and ABN, AHMG on what the expectations are, what the budget expectations are for our hires and our costs, and you know, making sure that AHMG operates within the budget. And I'm wondering, you know, how this works between the two organizations and how it will work going forward to avoid those kinds of variances in the future and avoid the high double-digit increases year after year. We all know we've been partly saved by some of the generosity of the federal government during the pandemic. That's not happening anymore. So how do we manage the situation where we have these two entities, and it seems like the controls don't work very well.
If I might, and certainly I would welcome you folks jumping in as well, but I had a really good conversation today with Dr. Achilles Warren, who is the president of AHMG, and we talked in depth about just this and the fact that we do need better controls mutually. And so she has some, I think, good ideas about how we can move forward together. And she will be talking, the AHMG board is meeting tomorrow, and I think she's going to be presenting some concepts to them. And so I'm not really at liberty to talk about, you know, I don't want to get ahead of her, but I do just want to make the board aware that Dr. Achilles Warren is acutely aware and has given, I think, good thought to how we might prevent this in the future.
I'm on the line here as well. I'm happy to comment on just my broad analysis of this.
Sure, please.
First of all, thanks for having me and for discussing this important topic. Just to go back to sort of where we started a few years ago, we had some ideas about what the clinical staffing needs were for the organization, but I don't think we had a complete idea. And I say that because we had about 50 physicians leave by the end of 2021. And so we had a huge departure, and to fill those vacancies, it's taken several years. So when we see that there are increases in hiring, some of those are net new hires, and typically those have gone through a process through our budget oversight committee most recently, but we had a previous iteration of that that allowed approvals for net new physician FTE. Some of these have been vacancies that have been open for 2 to 3 years. And so one question that I want to make sure that we do answer, and I think we can answer because we've recently gone through an exercise as of last month where we've actually quantified how much clinical staffing from a physician perspective we need for every service to function at its full capacity, to manage access, to be able to cover the services as they stand today. Now, whether we modify them or not, that's the question, but to cover services as they stand today, to make sure we have bodies to match the hours and the needs of the patient care that we have, we do have a sense of what that is. And I will say that it's far larger than where we started 4 years ago. And so it's hard to, when we say we had 14 hires approved for last year, yes, they were approved, but there were far more vacancies than that. And therefore we filled into those vacancies. And the controls that are in place right now, I would say need adjusting on both sides. We need better processes around how we determine the operational budget versus the financial, financially reflected budget for AHMG, because those are different. And really that staffing is controlled by each physician leader at the specialty level. They know exactly how much clinical FTE they need. And I can promise you that none of them are over FTE in terms of the number of FTE they need in order to staff their service. So I think that there's probably some opportunities for improvement around how we quantify what it is that we need to have in place from a physician workforce perspective to adequately staff our services, how much that's going to actually cost us, and then whether we want to adjust any of those services that we offer. Because at the end of the day, that's what's going to determine our FTE.
If I could just jump in for a second. I understand, and I think it's a good thing that the physician department or service leaders for each specialty know what their optimal number of physician FTEs is. But I think it's also critical that the administration know that number as well and know what to expect. So it sounds like, you know, if the department of, OBGYN, they know that they need 14 physicians, so I'm just pulling a number out of the air, that's great. But if AHS, HR, and finance thinks that number is 11, to them, there's a variance, and we're going to be over budget. So
right.
We need a way for there to be communication and documentation within, that both sides agree to one set of numbers, and ideally going into the 2025 budget year, one set of numbers, unless the situation changes, volume changes abruptly one way or the other, this is what the expectation is.
Right.
And I also think, I don't know if we have this, but other places I've been, the physician leadership and the administrative leadership have kind of an inventory of the physicians by specialty, by their specialty, but also by age. In many organizations, and it might not be true here, my observation, but in many organizations, the average age of physicians overall and in many specialties are getting up there a little bit, you wouldn't want them to run for president, I don't know if that's the case here, but I've seen in other organizations that they'll have a goal for each department going out 4 or 5 years of how many physicians they expect they're going to have to replace, and what kind of recruiting they're going to have to do. Now I know we're kind of making up on a lot of levels in our medical staff of where we are in managing it, but I'm just wondering if we have anything like any kind of an inventory like that, or we're expecting to have one, so we can see going forward where we need to be.
I think that's a good. Go ahead, Felicia.
I think that was. My understanding is we do not. I think we're working on a staffing plan. I was thinking maybe Chitra could speak to how she's doing on that.
Yeah, essentially we've completed it. Dr. Tonabene and I have reviewed it, and we have some prioritization that we would need to bring to the, we're gonna be bringing to the EOT next week and to the Budget Oversight Committee. But we have, sort of the full plans for every specialty, outlined, and they've been vetted to make sure that they are, meeting, like I said earlier, access standards, coverage standards that we expect to keep at this point. And then for specialties that are sort of exceeding those standards or need support in order to meet, backlogs and increase referrals and or demand from the patient side, then that's where we would need to do some in-depth financial analysis that we're hoping to complete in the next few weeks. So we should have, sort of a full picture of that, very, very shortly.
Well, I would hope on behalf of the board and ask that when we get to the 2025 budget that we can see some numbers on agreement between AHMG and AHS about what the number of physician FTEs should be, hopefully by specialty. And I understand that if you have, you know, people leaving, you may have to recruit more than you expected to recruit, but you should only be recruiting up to a number that is what's expected by the Budget Oversight Committee.
Yes, so just on the budget update, so for 22, the board approved an extra $3 million to $87 million, and that was for 183.9 FTE. As Chitra mentioned there, we had 18 and a half terms in 22 there. So the budget overage was $3 million for the year. And then here is budget 24. We increased it to $105,201.3 FTE. The recruitment was 14, and we actually have recruited 24.2. So we expect to be over for 24. And then here's
Can I interrupt on the previous slide? The impact of the 24.2 won't fully be felt until fiscal year 25. So we have a number of people that are starting in August, September, October of this year. But as far as the 24.2, 17 of those are vacancies and 7 are net new.
And I hope also there should be some relationship right between physician charges and the number of FTEs.
Well, we've got a couple slides on that. Here's the calendar year 24 impact. So our budget was 105, and you can see that we're going to be over that. This is the slide of just the physician expense. This is everything because, you know, in some cases there's locum, sometimes NHS pays, sometimes HMG. So this is supposed to give the total look, and you can see physician expenses are going up significantly, although our volumes are not. We're not quite back to pre-COVID levels. You asked for this, Trustee Fox, and you can see that our charges really aren't increasing that much because we have a CBM increase of about 3% a year, a little bit in 23. Our net collections are doing better, and that is to do with the revenue cycle and physician documentation. That is a joint effort, and that is improving. But our incremental costs in physician fees, $14.1 million in 22, $12.1 in 23, and $17.2 million in 24, we don't have the revenue to support that. Some of this is kind of a TBD, to be determined, because we don't know yet. These docs, as Dr. Achilles Foran just said, many of them haven't started yet, right? So we need to do some work with the budget. Are they going to work in the clinic? Are we going to get, revenue? Are we going to reduce call? I mean, there's a lot of those conversations that need to happen. I think, Chitra, you have some more slides here, or maybe Dr. Trundin?
Dr. Kellis-Warren, do you want to
speak to
this one?
This is just sort of background context, but I think that we know as an industry that physician hospital arrangements have changed. Most physicians are employed, whereas they used to be independent, contractors or independent practices. That's really been a change in the last really like 10 years that the majority of physicians now are employed, and employing physicians is more expensive than contracting them. That's something that's felt by everyone in the industry. I think that in the recent years, I would say post-COVID, there's now sort of an additional threat of just physicians leaving the workforce. So I think we've done a really good job at both hiring when it's been really difficult to hire physicians in a very competitive landscape, but also retaining. Our turnover last year was 2%. We only have 12 terms predicted for this calendar year. Which would put us a little bit higher than that, but not very far behind. Given what's happening in other systems, I think we're in a pretty good place. And I think, we've spent the last 3 years really trying to make this place an attractive place to work for physicians. think that the next step that we have to do at this point is understanding where physicians spend their time and how they can spend their time increasingly on revenue generating work.
Makes sense.
I don't think I need to speak much to this. We've already kind of gone through all these different points, but just the history of HMG, what we've done in terms of moving contracted physicians to employment, and then how we've really spent the last 2 years focusing mostly on strategic expansions, not just on sort of backfilling vacancies, but actually expanding services that we're offering.
So I'll add a question for you, Dr. Killiswaran. In view of the increases that we put through a few years ago in physician compensation and the new contract, what's your feeling about how competitive we are now with other hospitals and systems? Everybody's trying to hire, you know, the best physicians. Are we in a good position now? Are we still disadvantaged in that regard? Or are we in a position now where we can, you know, get some of the most talented physicians that are coming into the area?
We are extremely competitive. Since the 2022 compensation restructure, which not only was to improve base pay for a number of specialties to a relatively minimum competitive rate, but also to ensure equity across physicians. So making sure that all specialties were benchmarked to the same level, making sure that people within a specialty were paid the same for the same work. You know, I'll say this, I've hired a lot of physicians, and based on the conversations I've had where I've said, we do not negotiate base pay, I haven't had a single person really turn me down on that reason alone. So I think that we are very competitive. That's not the only factor. Obviously, people that come to the county come for a mission. They come because they're willing to take a little bit of a pay cut for the benefits of working with our population. They understand all that, but they also really like the framework that we have, where we ensure that we are paying people the same for the same work and that it's equitable.
How well do we compete against Kaiser? Because, I mean, Kaiser is really where everybody's competing against, right, for physicians.
I would say where we have good physician leadership, the areas that we are struggling the most now, and this is a very direct correlation, in terms of staffing, have to do with leadership. So where we are missing a chair, a permanent chair, or we've recently had a transition of a chair and we're doing some cleanup, that's where we lose physicians. That's where we have turnover. That's very normal. Where we have stable, solid physician leadership, which we've hired 5 chairs in the last 3 years, we've hired 10 division chiefs, they're all really solid. We have very little turnover. And where we most often lose physicians to is Kaiser, but it's usually not because they want to go to Kaiser. It's because they don't want to, they cannot stay here. It's usually a running away, not running towards.
Why are they running away?
Because of if they don't have a stable team and stable leadership, the environment of work is challenging. So that's the most predictive factor, whether we have retention or not, is whether how intact that team is.
What I've been able to observe, which may not be right, but it seems to me that the age of our medical staff, at least the leadership, is aging is not a problem.
No.
Like I've seen in other places.
It's not. We had a very strong bell curve when I first started. We had a lot of people that were less than 5 years out of training and then more than 15. And we were missing people between 5 and 15 years, which is really the workhorse of the workforce. We did a lot of adjustment on that compensation restructure, but also on benefits, also on other aspects, including installing appropriate leadership, making sure that the job felt sustainable over time to attract those people that are more experienced and keep them here. And so we have a lot more even population, but I would say the majority of our physicians are around 10 years or less from training.
That's great. Okay.
Follow-up question, Dr. Killiswaran. Maybe this is Dr. Tornabene. Going way back to the beginning, I didn't understand a point of clarity possibly here. Is there a discussion between AHS and your team on the level of staffing that is needed per specialty or per practice? And I didn't understand from the response if that occurs or is being planned to occur? To adjust your staffing levels according to what Chair Fox was mentioning was that that's done internally by the team, your teams, and that they are looking at their staffing level and the appropriate staffing level. His comment was that there should be agreement between AHS and your organization to ensure that those staffing levels meet the actual need. Is that discussion, does that discussion occur?
So I'll start and then Dr. Kloss-Warren can add. So over the past 2 years, when there have been service expansions or additional FTEs that are needed, typically there is a presentation that comes forward by the clinical leader. And in prior times, it was a physician contracting meeting, but for well over a year, it comes to a budget oversight committee. And those, we work with Kim's team to drop the pro forma that's presented at budget oversight approval for approval. What Dr. Kloss-Warren was referring to earlier was that, Dr. Kloss-Warren, myself, Emily on Dr. Kloss-Warren's team have been sequentially meeting for months with all of the specialty leaders around, okay, what is the FTE that is needed for the clinical services? And then that will be presented next week to the executive operations team so that the entire executive team has a chance to hear about all of the clinical operations and the FTE needed. Dr. Kloss-Warren, do you have anything to add to my statements there?
Yeah, I would say that it's been extremely iterative. I would say this is the first year when we've done this concerted staffing plan effort. I do think it was done internally, but it wasn't, it was communicated in a very iterative way. So specialty by specialty, as services needed to expand or contract, that's where we learned exactly how much FTE was required. That being said, when the organization started, of course, there were minimum clinical FTE allocated to each specialty. Incrementally, there have been expansions. And so to get the full picture of where every specialty lands and then what the overall needs are, I think we have sort of required this very concentrated staffing plan process that we've undertaken over the last couple of months.
Yeah, I think this slide kind of summarizes that, right?
The issue is how do we pay for it?
Yeah. Because, thank you. I'll leave it at that. Exactly.
Well, fortunately, we've done such a good job collecting, billing and collecting, that it's helping to offset the probably lower productivity of some of the newer physicians as they get their feet on the ground.
We do have in the grit that the physicians are supposed to get up to. We just have the 40th percentile built in there, and it's 25% each 3 months they're here. And for the docs that have started, the last group that we thought we'd have 14 and 24 or whatever, those guys are close to that target. We were really close at Q2 grit.
It sounds like you're getting good cooperation from the physicians on the physician documentation side.
Oh, I would say that has been really positive. Dr. Kloss-Warren, maybe you want to comment on that because.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's been a journey. Last year, we published our first sort of physician-facing dashboard in Epic with the help of Mark's team, Kim's team, Dr. Tornabene's team. It was a very, very multi-pronged effort. And then, of course, many physicians who volunteered their time to validate the data and whatnot. And that has RVUs on it. So this is the first time, as of the last 9 months, that physicians are seeing their own personal work RVUs being published to them in nearly real time. I mean, there's some delays, of course, with the way the charges are dropped and whatnot and collections are done, but that's sort of the first of it. Now, there's been a lot of interesting insights from that work that the physicians have been continuing to meet about, which is how do we refine that data? How do we make sure that's adequately capturing the work that we're doing? How do we improve our documentation? And so there were some coding education efforts that we undertook this past fiscal year to actually educate by specialty every group on how they can improve their clinical documentation and billing and coding to capture additional revenue. We then learned from that process that there were a number of opportunities around billing workflows that we could then actually implement. And Sherry's team has been really instrumental in that. She's really been leading the charge around how we go specialty by specialty, which we just kicked off last week, to actually build refined billing workflows that are physician specific so that we are, again, maximizing the revenue that we capture. And that has also required a lot of physician engagement. So I anticipate, you know, my sort of story is that we spent 3 years really stabilizing this part of the workforce, which was crumbling. And we now have the opportunity to optimize it. And I think we're in a number of ways trying to do that and increasingly generate the revenue to sort of offset these costs. So I'm hoping that we see some real benefits from that effort in the next 12 months.
Well, thank you for your support of that effort. Because as you know, if the physicians don't document it, we can't bill it. And a lot of times physicians are resistant to efforts to try to, you know, get them to make that extra effort, but apparently not here, so that's great.
The engagement has just been incredible.
So thanks for your support on that also, yeah. Dr. Tornabene.
Sure, yeah, I'm excited. I mean, the first three specialties in the WAVE are obstetrics, so, you know, Dr. Phyllis Warren's specialty, orthopedics and ENT, you know, and then we'll be going through, I mean, Sherry Johnson has just been incredible in leading this and working with external partner and our IS colleagues to move into this series of waves of specialties to go through, you know, all of our specialties over the next 12 to 18 months.
The graph says it all. I mean, expenses are rising at a higher rate than patient days, and that is concerning when someone views this chart and understands what it means. It's wonderful work you're doing. It's wonderful that the physicians are willing to discuss revenue and coding and all that will increase revenue and recognize all the great work they're doing, because in the long term, this is, if I may say, unsustainable.
Yeah. Well, that's why we need to get our arms around it and get better control of the expenses.
Yes.
We're looking out at that NNB.
Yes, we are.
And there's not going to be another pandemic.
Making sure that the size of the workforce matches the demand for services. And I don't have the data necessary to make that judgment, but when you look at charts like that, it calls that into question. But I'm not going to make any judgment on that other than to say the data suggests that there's need for concern.
Yep. Well said, thank you.
That is our report.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Phyllis Warren.
Thank you.
Tornabene. Any questions, any further questions from the committee? Okay, good report. We'll look forward to more information as we get closer to approving next year's budget. And next on the agenda is we have one contract to discuss tonight. And that is lease at 7200 Bancroft.
Trustee Fox, is that under my name? I think it is. Yeah, this is actually an addendum to an existing contract we have. And Ira, I see you're on. Maybe I'll hand it over to you.
I think you might be on mute, Ira.
Oh, we can't hear you, Ira. So he's calling in.
He's got his back home. Only you and I, David. The purpose of that.
Oh, we love that. I think Ira's calling in. Mona's taking a bit. I let him in. She's very excited.
Very excited? Very excited.
Okay,
All righty, I'm on my phone. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Perfect. Sorry about that. My computer microphone decided to die completely today. So, the document in front of you is a summary of a proposed addendum to our lease agreement for our Eastmont Wellness Clinic. Per the terms of this, we're requesting board approval to move forward with the dental clinic expansion at Eastmont. This project is in budget, and the details are laid out in the summary. Are there any questions? Would you like me to go through the summary?
I had a question. In the description section, it talks about the fact that the landlord will provide funding for the dental clinic TIs. So I'm wondering why we are asked to approve $2.6 million for the TIs, and yet the text says there's no negative fiscal implications. And why are you being asked for $2.6 million?
We're being asked for the additional funding, sir, because when we entered into the current lease back in 2022, I believe, we did not have complete construction plans in hand at that time. It's just the way the sequencing went, but we knew that we were going to want to do the expansion. To the best of our knowledge then, we included a certain amount for tenant improvements, and the landlord agreed to do that. As time progressed, we had a complete construction plan that was created, and upon reviewing and putting those to bid, the landlord identified these additional costs. It is those additional costs that are before the board for approval today, which are necessary to fund the expansion.
Okay, so the landlord originally agreed to pay X amount in TIs, and now after we've had a couple of years to year and a half or whatever it is to plan in more detail, we're finding that we need more. And I guess the landlord's saying, okay, you can have more, but it's on you. Is that basically
that is
what's happening?
Yeah. That's a fair statement.
We're talking about 50% greater, 5.5 original, now 2.5. That's fairly significant. It isn't just a small increase. Did the plan change significantly? I'm missing why the increase would be so dramatic.
I think that the increase was because over that period of 2 years, as I said, there was additional understanding of what was actually needed. There is often increase and inflation in construction. I can't speak to the very specifics that granularly drove that percentage, but I do understand that that is the fundamental driver here. We just needed additional time to spec everything out. Once we had those additional very detailed plans, that was the time that we could actually map out the true costs of it. Time changed, there was inflation as well as greater detail. I think those are the two elements there.
Has the size of the clinic or any of the services changed?
I think a little over the course of the 2 years. Yeah, I mean, we added back in a sterile processing area, et cetera.
I don't remember, I was on the board when it was originally approved. I don't remember what the original profitability of the clinic was or what the net revenue is in proportion to the expenses.
We've got that, Alan, but I'm not ready to discuss it tonight. I don't have any fun.
I don't remember. Do you remember, Kim? Is the clinic, is it anticipated that the clinic will be break even? Or, I mean, obviously we're a mission organization.
Yeah.
We don't expect everything to.
No, I think I'm going to go from memory. But I think the pro forma was good because we've got a big backlog in dental, and with this expansion, we have the ability to push through more volume. Significantly more volume because we're adding two, I think, new chairs as well. So that helped perform quite a bit.
And current performance is?
I'm not sure.
I will say just anecdotally that we're expanding 20,000 square feet of dental space because of 6 month and longer wait lists.
Yeah.
So I want to validate that there is a backlog for dental services in that community. And wouldn't be surprised if you would have, your schedules would be full. That wouldn't surprise me.
We've got a significant backlog. And in fact, we're thinking about going out and trying to gain a $5 million grant to help us expand into child adolescent as well.
Yeah.
More than we are, more surgical child adolescent. It's a big service line for us.
It is.
So we don't have dental services there at all now, right?
Where?
At Eastmont.
We do. We have a small child adolescent presence in the clinic itself.
Okay.
Not separate. This whole project is separate, but across the hallway, kind of.
So is this new project going to be adult and adolescent?
Adult only, I know. Okay. I think. Yeah.
All right. Well, I know as a few years ago, construction costs in the Bay Area were increasing 20% a year.
And Alan, I think if you recall, the reason the executive team exited our current space, we left HCP3 here on the campus because that whole area will eventually be remodeled for the residency trauma dental program.
Where we're sitting right now?
Where
your office
right over there.
Used to be.
Yep. Yeah. So it's a growing program, and this is really a good thing for us.
And we did engage with an FQ consultant because all of this would have implications with the rates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm comfortable recommending approval.
Would you like to make that motion?
I motion that we approve the amendment as written.
Second.
Trustee Fox.
Aye.
Trustee Garrett.
Aye.
Trustee Seiden.
Aye.
Motion passes.
Okay, thank you. We are finished. Unless there's anything else to come before the committee. All right, thank you, everyone. Thank you.